Today, extend and pretend squared. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, working the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I'm joined again by Tarek Brooker, journalist. Hi Tarek.
G'day Martin, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good. So Friday afternoon, time for another chat, and boy, a big week.
Oh, it most certainly has been. You know, we've seen, you know, the extension of the insolvency moratorium, which is absolutely huge. You know, we've seen in WA and Victoria, we've also seen the extension of the eviction moratoriums. And, you know, now we've also seen these changes by APRA, which is sort of extend and pretend forever.
Yes. So let's be honest and upfront here, all right? Capitalism doesn't exist in Australia at the moment, does it?
No, it doesn't.
You know, in the real world, there are going to be winners and losers. Capital, you know, grows or shrinks. People take risks, and sometimes it pays off and sometimes it doesn't pay off, right? What we have now is a set of systems and processes that is trying to keep all the balls in the air all the time. And as a result of that, nobody can fail.
Exactly. And I think it's really important that we sort of explore the impact that's going to have on the economy, that it's going to have on housing prices, that it's going to have on all of these various different things, because it does serve to kick the can down the road. I mean, you know, if we were to sort of play out a scenario for a moment of an alternative September 2020, under which there was no mortgage deferrals, there was no, you know, sort of provisions by APRA to allow the banks to obscure the number of bad loans and loans in arrears they actually have, we'd be looking at a very, very different scenario. We'd be looking at a scenario with mortgage arrears probably north well of 5% if other nations are anything to go by. And I think it's important that we sort of assess how that's affected confidence, because, you know, as we've seen in recent days, there are quite a few people that are bullish on property.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, how suddenly some of those who were quite bearish, like CBA, for example, had a worst-case scenario of 30% down on property prices. They've now come back and said, oh, no, it's all changed now. And suddenly there might be a slight wobble this year, but next year it's going to be up. And, you know, Christopher Joy picked that up and said, oh, the bears are, you know, going bullish. Well, one bear, CBA. But it is interesting that there are more people now saying, well, maybe this isn't going to be quite as bad as we first thought. The thing I'm just wrestling with is that consumer confidence is still pretty shaky. Okay, the Melbourne Institute data was a little bit more positive this week, but, you know, still off. But the business confidence level is right the way down through the floor. The last PMI statistics were right down through the floor. And look, without business beginning to actually investing and building for the future, there is no future for the economy as far as I can see.
No, there isn't. I mean, I think that's a really important point that Jace Murphy made for news.com recently. He had an article out a few days ago, which I tweeted out earlier today. And it really just laid out how there is this massive disconnect between the reality of the real economy and what households are experiencing. Now, I suggest anyone who hasn't read it to go have a read, because it contains this fantastic graph from CBA showing that households are getting 16% more income on average than this time last year. Now, that's an absolutely huge amount of money. I mean, you know, we've seen, you know, sort of low 2% wage rises here in Australia now for the better part of the last 4 or 5 years. So that's like getting 8 years worth of wage increases, you know, or thereabouts, in one go, all in one go, just like that. And I think that really speaks volumes as to why we haven't seen consumer confidence collapse further than it has. Like, if you get into the nitty-gritty, especially my favourite's the ANZ Weekly Index, because it shows you the breakdown of all the various different questions that people get asked. It shows that people think, they believe that their household's going to be okay, that they're going to, that in 12 months' time, things are going to be better for them. But it's not really surprising that they feel that way when you're throwing an extra 16% of incomes or wages at the average household, you know, while it doesn't really show you those households, you know, maybe it's someone who operates a tourism firm or someone who works as an engineer at Qantas. You don't see those people really represented because they're sort of overwhelmed by this flood of money that we're starting to now see come to a bit of a tapering.
Mm. Well, it is worth just thinking about this. There's more than 3 million on JobKeeper, right? And another 2 million, give or take, on JobSeeker, right? So let's say in round numbers, 5 million, right? Now, that's a large chunk of the population, right? And we know that a proportion of those on JobKeeper were getting a lot more than they were before this all happened. In other words, they were, you know, getting above what they were getting previously. And of course, the JobSeeker payment's been, you know, much higher because of the supplements. And so that is part of the reason. And it's interesting, if you look at the savings ratios, they're way up. So people are actually putting some of it away. Also, a lot of other people are paying loans down, which, by the way, I think is extremely sensible. And that's precisely what I would be doing if I had loans at the moment. But it does really highlight, I think, that there is a gap between, you know, what's really going on and what the perceptions are. Because, as you say, if individuals are actually feeling a bit better because, you know, money's coming through the door at the moment, remember, of course, folks, that these are going to be tapered down from the end of September, both JobKeeper and JobSeeker. And the plan is pretty much by early next year, they have disappeared completely. And the question I have, Tariq, is with all these other measures, like the APRA measure to allow banks not to declare bad loans, you know, that's going to finish, what, March next year at the moment, right? The issue about trading insolvent is actually going to finish in December. The rental holidays, well, they've kicked it out now, I think, to the end of the year in a number of states, but that's going to come to an end. The issue I've got is all of this is, you know, la-la land insofar that it's not real. It's going to come to an end. And you know, unless they just keep on going and going and going, and perhaps until after the next election, we're going to end up with that crunch. Now, the crunch might be a more sort of slidey crunch rather than a drop off a cliff now, but it's still there, isn't it?
It is, but I mean, I don't know. Like, I look at the data, I look at that chart from UBS that you sent me, but perhaps you can put that up on the screen. Mm. And it to me, I don't really see how you manage to get through that transition from Q3 to Q4 without there being significant pain for households, without there being, you know, significant job losses, because it's such a huge amount of money. You know, you're talking about, you know, somewhere between $60 and $70 billion being pulled out of the economy in a single quarter, which is like, you know, 12-14% of quarterly GDP, which is a huge, huge amount of money. Yeah, but by the same token, there's also just the fact that confidence is now going to be so fragile going forward. You know, it didn't take much. You know, like, the government stepped in and then boom, confidence rebounded. Most significantly in that area that I mentioned, that people believe that their household will be insulated. And that worked fantastically well. Confidence shot up right off the low base in April. But the question is what's going to happen now that that's tapered? It's because this thing is going to these changes are going to directly impact households. You know, it's all well and good to say, oh, this is withdrawals, this percentage of GDP, and et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And we've got these very, very overarching, very, very broad, you know, explorations of the point. But that doesn't really speak to the fact that of how much households have seen their incomes increase and how much they're going to see their incomes decrease when it stops. Because as we know, GDP is a very, very poor indicator of real household outcomes.
Mm. Well, that's true. And the thing I want to just highlight, of course, is that we've got another side to this story. We know that, looking at my stress indicators, right, there are other households who really have not seen any significant increase in income, or more likely, they've lost other elements. So essentially net, they're actually not so well ahead, and indeed quite often are underwater at the moment. Now, that's now, right? With all of this stimulus we're talking about, that's now, with all of the JobKeeper and JobSeeker and the withdrawal of super and everything else, right? What's going to happen when it just fades away, right? I have a worry that the stress numbers will get even more adverse. And it's also just worth reflecting on this. You know, all those people who've had their loans postponed, right? So they're not making any capital or principal repayments, right? they are just pushing it down the track, right? At some point, they're going to have to start repaying again, right? And I reckon the banks have probably capitalized something like $2.8 to $3 billion worth of loans at the moment with all of the rolling up that's been going on, right? So the banks' books are getting bigger at the expense of the fact that no one's making their repayments. But again, that's got to come to an end at some point. So, you know, we are in this sort of low, I suppose, is the way I think about it, is these low fields before the hills start again the other side, right? And you can sort of see the hills over there, and you know you're going to have to get over them. The trouble is, I'm not sure there are any helicopters that can help us.
Well, I think part of the problem is that, you know, we've got this team of people furiously building this sort of stage ahead of us that just, you know, that just obscures, you know, that the hills ahead, so, you know, nobody notices, you know, in a sort of Wile E. Coyote fashion. Yeah. You know, but I think that you make some really important points. And, you know, as we were talking about, you know, earlier about APRA, I think that it's entirely possible that we could see extend and pretend all the way to the next election. Hmm. Because if there is an election in August or September next year, that's not really that far away from the March deadline. And I noticed in your video from yesterday that you mentioned that basically that under the new, you know, guidelines from APRA, they can keep restructuring loans. Yep. Time and time and time again.
Yep.
And that basically means that if the banks keep restructuring these loans, they're never going to show up in arrears.
Hmm.
They could just restructure
it,
the time.
It resets,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. So that is, you know, perhaps the crux of this entire conversation, because they can just keep saying, "Oh no, that this loan is performing. This loan is performing every 90 days, forever and ever." I mean, that's something that we saw in the US. Yep. You know, you had people default. And then the bank would go, okay, we're gonna lower the interest rate, or we're gonna change some various attributes of your repayments, and we're going to go bang, you're gonna repay this loan, we've restructured it, and then they default again, and then they restructure again, and then they default again. There was a great video from a real estate expert on Real Vision, and he was talking about people defaulting 4, 5, 6 times, and here they are. Almost 12 years after the financial crisis began, and these people are still living in these houses and not paying any money because the bank doesn't want to take the write down on them.
Yep. Well, this is serious, right? So there are about, according to the APRA statistics, about 800,000 accounts that are actually at the moment in repayment of principal holiday, right? And that equates to about 9% of all lending, right? And within that, if you look at the SME sector, I think it's something like 17% of SMEs are actually on hold at the moment, and around 9% of mortgages, right? And in fact, this time APRA's released very granular information. So you can actually go down to individual lender and you can see how each individual lender has handled this, right? So for example, CBA was very upfront in terms of allowing SMEs to take those holidays. So a larger proportion of SMEs for CBA, because it was pretty much automatic, whereas you had to apply for some of the other banks, right? So that's one of the reasons why the CBA number might look a bit worse. But we know that Westpac and Bank of Queensland have some of the highest exposures in terms of those repayment holidays for the mortgage books. And interestingly, if you look at things like the interest-only loans and the investor loans, you know, on average, it's about 34% of all those people taking holidays are investors. So quite a few investors are being given a free pass at the moment. And there are quite a lot of interest-only loans as well. You know, so you can actually now begin to look at this at a very granular level and realize that not all banks are the same. Not all banks are actually executing the strategy the same way. But APRA has given them a perfect opportunity to essentially just roll and roll and roll and roll and just keep rolling. And I suppose the idea is, maybe, that if you roll it long enough, eventually property prices will catch up, and, you know, job prospects will catch up, and income might catch up, and then suddenly it'll magically be all right again. But boy, that's a big bet.
It is a big bet, and it could take a very long time. But I can't help but think that that's sort of an increasingly considered scenario in Martin Place, you know, when all the sort of council of financial regulators sit down and they just go, "Oh, well, we've got to do something."
Yes.
But I was going to ask you, I was having a look through the APRA data myself yesterday, and I was just wondering, I noticed that they changed the terminology on the graphs and on the data from exited to exited or expired. Yep. So I was wondering, I remember you, I'm not sure if it was you or someone else, but they mentioned that not everyone was being given a 6-month loan deferral.
Correct.
Are these people actually exiting and starting to repay, or, you know, and everything's going back to normal, or are they being asked by the bank to exit the deferral because there's no chance that they're going to pay that back?
Well, I think there are two things going on. Firstly, the banks have started phoning people up now and trying to get a sounding on where people are. I've had a few people actually update me on the conversation with the bank, right? And it goes one of two ways. The first conversation is, you know, looks to me, they say, and perhaps they're seeing the salaries coming into the account, that you can now afford to start repaying. So you should start repaying, you know. So that 6 months isn't automatic, right? So can you please start repaying? Mm-hmm. And some have. So there is a small drop in the proportion that actually have, you know, now extended beyond. So that's the first thing. The second is, for some people, the conversation is very different, which is you appear now to be in a situation where your income is permanently crippled, as it were, and it's unlikely that you are going to be able to start repaying those loans at some point. So we recommend that what you do is put your property in the market and basically start the process or a formalized selling cycle, not a default, right? The last thing the banks want, a default. They want to keep that default number really, really low. And if you can encourage somebody to essentially move towards selling the property, and, you know, if the property market is not dropping that quickly, then it's probably a good time to do it. Because then there's enough opportunity potentially to create the transaction to repay the bank, and everybody then is home and hosed. Remember, of course, that we have full recourse in Australia, which means that whatever you left owing the bank after the property is sold, you still owe the bank. And so there is an incentive for some people, particularly if properties are prices are falling, to sell soon, because the longer you leave it, the lower the value could well be, and therefore the more chances that you're going to end up with negative equity, and therefore you know, you've got lots of issues beyond it. So those are the two sets of conversations. But I have to say that the more I look at this granularity in the information, the less clear it becomes, right? And I think this is another great example of more information is not necessarily good information, right? It seems to me that they've been quite careful in the way that they've shared some pieces of information, but some of the critical stuff is missing. So in a way, you know, it's almost like a pseudo accurate picture of what's going on, but I think it's very myopic.
Yeah, well, I had a look into their spreadsheets and all the various things they provide, and I was looking for, okay, well, you've said this number of people have seen their things exit or expire, and I'm like, well, how many people have actually seen theirs expire? How many people are actually in that position where they're being, you know, sort of forced to either start repaying or to consider selling their property?
Yep.
And that sort of leads me into my next question, which is how are things sort of playing out in terms of, you know, investors and just people in general looking to potentially transact at the moment, according to your surveys?
Yeah, so there's some very interesting data, and I was talking to a property buyer down in Melbourne today, who is also noticing it's too, that there is actually a bit of a listing rise. So people are beginning to think about putting their properties up into the market, and quite a few of them are property investors. In my surveys, about a quarter of the people in my surveys who are property investors are underwater on a cash flow basis. And quite a few of those are also people with deferrals, right? And those deferrals have two faces. The first set of deferrals relate to the principal and interest mortgages that they're not paying. The second is, of course, their rental streams are often deferred as well. So it's a like sort of, you know, money in, money out. No, neither is happening at the moment, right? What happens if one starts and the other doesn't start? So all of those things are in train at the moment. And the fact that they've now extended the rental holidays for quite a few renters means that effectively more property investors are going to be caught in this pincer movement where the bank is going to say, right, well, start repaying. And the investor's saying, well, actually, I haven't got any rental income, so what do I do, you know? That's why more people are selling. So we are definitely seeing an uptick. Now, it's not uniform across all postcodes, and it's not uniform across all property types. but I can tell you that there are a lot of high-rise units, particularly in and around the suburban footprint, for example, Melbourne 3000 and just around there, where people are signalling their intention to try and sell, and quite quickly. So I think we're going to see more property listings ahead. How many, of course, is the interesting question, because at the moment in Melbourne, the property market is somewhat locked down, right? Because you can't really show people and take photographs and what have you. So it'll be interesting to see at what point that bites. But in other states, we are seeing some property investors thinking, well, maybe it's a good time. And then the other scenario is property investors with multiple properties. So this is the cross-leveraged investor where they've taken one property, built a bit of equity, used the equity to buy number two, et cetera, number three, et cetera, right? And now the equity is beginning to decay and the cash flow is weak. So in some cases, what they're now doing is saying, now, which one should I sell? Should I sell the one with the biggest capital appreciation or should I sell the dog, right? And it's interesting how quite often people automatically go for, well, if I sell the one with the most appreciation, I've then got more value than I can use. But in fact, quite often the right answer is sell the dog, because the dog is going to stay the dog, whereas actually some of these others may be more valuable later. So it's a really tricky situation. But again, we're seeing that in the survey. So I think that we are going to see more listings ahead.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Like, I mean, you know, Cookie Boy does his domain listings roundup every couple of weeks, and I've been noticing that, you know, that we've been seeing nationwide listings come down. Now, I don't know how much of that is driven by the fact that we are seeing the lockdown in Melbourne, and obviously Melbourne is, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's actually a bigger market than Sydney, generally speaking, in terms of listings on an average basis. So it's really quite interesting just to see how all this is going to unfold, because we really do live in an increasingly sort of, the property market's base is increasingly narrow, in the sense that it's a very, very small number of properties being transacted on that is actually driving the market higher. You know, we're seeing fewer properties being transacted on, and I mean, they peaked back in like 2016 in Sydney, and we've seen it quite rapidly decline. You know, I mean, we've seen numbers as of now, as of this rolling period. I went through the domain's data with it's something like less than, I think it's down by about nearly 60% from where it was back in sort of 2015, 2016, when things were a little bit better for the real estate sector. So I think that that's something that's really important to remember, that even when we did have this property boom, whether it boomed or not, I mean, obviously as a matter of conjecture, I realize, you know, between the election and pre-COVID, that was really built on a very narrow base of rising loan sizes and of fewer and fewer buyers as turnover continued to decline. So while that did create a very sort of, at least in CoreLogic's numbers, a very, very, you know, sort of rapid increase in prices, it's also an extremely fragile market, in the sense that all it takes is a little bit more supply to sort of tip things in the other direction. That's sort of the point, I think, that Edwin's been making quite a lot in his what do you guys call it there? His Monday property rants.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, you know, Edwin is very hot on just that point. And I'd make this point. If you look at the average first-time buyer loan, right, recently compared with, let's say, a year ago, right, that loan value went up somewhere between 6 and 10%. Right. And that has been where a lot of the growth has come from, right? Because effectively the banks have dialed back some of their lending standards to allow people to get bigger loans. And of course, James Shipton, the ASIC head, the other day said, well, he's not going to pursue the Westpac case because basically the world has changed, which implicitly says, now, responsible lending? Oh, don't worry about it. Just lend, banks. You know, if anybody wants a loan, that's no problem, right? I mean, it is remarkable that we've swung so far the other way, because, of course, the compression in the market was as a result specifically of the Royal Commission, when effectively the Royal Commission was questioning the basis on which responsible lending was actually being made. So we've got weakness in responsible lending. We've got weakness in provisions, right? We've got weakness in jobs, and, you know, unemployment looks likely to rise from this point. And let's not forget that, folks. And we know that income's not rising, and we know that potentially costs of living are rising. I mean, all the parameters, when you stand back and think about it, are all pointing in one direction, And yet you've still got the spruikers saying, no, 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 everything's fine. The property market's going to recover and, you know, everything's super duper. And by 2021, the prices will be up to, what, 20%, according to some people? I mean, it is quite remarkable. And it goes back to this fundamental point, of course, which is that our economy is an economy based on holes, digging stuff out of the ground and shipping overseas, and homes, right? And the fact is that these homes are overvalued in any metric that you can think about. And the exposure that we now have with the high household debt is worse than pretty much any other country in the world. And yet the solution that is being offered to get us out of this hole is to actually lend more, but build and buy more houses and basically just keep the cycle going on again. At some point, the music's got to stop. The question is, when will the music stop?
Indeed. I think it's really interesting just to look at the sort of problems and that question on a sort of at a lower level, I'd say a city level. Say, like, I look at Melbourne, and Melbourne is obviously suffering horribly because of the lockdown, because of COVID, and it's really quite a disaster for Melbourne economically. You know, we see all these various forecasts and things from people like, you know, PricewaterhouseCoopers and all these people talking about sort of a big hit and a big hit for, you know, 4 or 5 years to come.
Yes, written, of course, by people who have a vested interest in an outcome, right? So it's not completely objective. Those sorts of models probably never are. But I'm a bit sceptical as to the way that information is being picked up and thrown at Andrews.
Yeah, well, there's always that in the background, isn't there? I mean, I think it's always important to take, you know, things with a grain of salt, and, you know, where you can sort of see, okay, where exactly is this coming from? But I look at Victoria and I just think to myself, okay, you've got all these enormous problems. You're going to have, you know, rising unemployment far higher than the rest of Australia in all likelihood. And I just look at it and I can't help but think to myself, well, if Victoria does get itself into sort of deep trouble, you know, more so even than the rest of the country, even if the rest of the country does sort of okay-ish, you know, how is that sort of going to play out for the rest of the country? You know, because, you know, they're talking about New South Wales getting hit by the lockdown and by Victoria struggling, because obviously, you know, we're one country, as much as some people in Western Australia may think otherwise. And it just makes me sort of wonder, like, what is going to happen in terms of that? Is Victoria just going to be a drag on the national economy for years to come? And talking about it even just from the property market perspective, are the bad loans in Victoria that we're going to see as a result of the lockdown and as a result of all of what we've seen over the last few months, are we going to see a tightening of credit as a result of that Australia-wide because of the number of bad loans in Victoria, as we saw, say, in the US, when, say, for example, you've got places like Las Vegas or Miami, which dragged the entire country down with it, while in actual fact there were places in the Midwest, you know, where housing was very affordable from the beginning, that only maybe fell 10 or 15%.
I think that there are signs already of differential lending rules in different locations. I've noticed that WA, the lending rules, which were tighter, are now being loosened up a bit. So, you know, that's an example where the Western Australian economy looks to be perhaps driving prices slightly more aggressively than previously. But I think you're right. I think that Victoria will be the sink pit, if you like, in terms of prices. I'm already seeing that in my forward projections. So if I take the average fall in Victoria, it's significantly higher than even, you know, New South Wales or worse, you know, or even Queensland, right? And Tasmania and South Australia look to me to be potentially able to cope with quite mild falls. There will be some falls, but it won't be dramatic. But I guess, you know, if I think about it, there are so many variables at the moment that it's really hard to try and actually triangulate what is likely to happen. That's one of the reasons why I run scenarios, because you've got a series of economic issues, and we've got a series of regulatory interventions and the Reserve Bank, but you've also got a political overlay, right? And I'm just sort of, you know, thinking about this politically speaking, right? Because there are two factors. The first is, I have got so many people in my survey saying, nothing to fear here because the government will save us, right? You know, the government will get us out of this, not a problem. We'll just carry on the way we are. And of course, we've got the election coming up within the next year or so. So we've already got people in Canberra basically thinking about, how do I win the election, right? And my worry is that the focus is going to be on short-termism to be able to get us from here to the election, rather than a more strategic view of what needs to be done beyond. And for me, that's probably the most sickening part of all this. I just feel that the decision-making framework is actually the wrong lens. But perhaps I'm just naive.
No, I don't think you are. I mean, I all you have to do is really look at Scott Morrison's polling numbers, and they're fantastic. I mean, for him as an individual, yeah, News Poll's 50-50 in terms of two-party preferred. But in terms of ScoMo himself, they're fantastic. He's got an approval rating of like 65%. Mm. That's huge for an Australian Prime Minister.
Yep.
You know, normally someone's unhappy with him. I mean, amongst the Liberals, his approval rating is over 90%. Now, for a bloke who represents, I mean, if you spend any time around the sort of the rank and file Liberal Party, a lot of them are small business owners. A lot of them are, you know, of the entrepreneurial sort of type, in my experience, when I've you know, spoken and interviewed these people. And I find it quite mad that 91% of them are backing ScoMo when he's basically presiding over the death of small business in Australia in massive, massive numbers. You know, he promised $40 billion for small business owners, and they've got 1.9. The money hasn't gotten through. Yes, JobKeeper's been helpful to a lot of businesses, and I've spoken to a lot of people who are very appreciative of that.
Mm.
But it's only one part of a much greater whole, and I think part of the problem is that now, with that support, with all these various different things, the government's been incentivized to focus on these things that have political mileage. You know, there's no political mileage in getting all the states and territories together and going, oh, we're going to drought-proof Australia.
Mm.
There's bugger all political mileage in that. You know, sure, people like you and me will go, yeah, great. But for the most part, it's not going to set the news headlines on fire like $750 for every Centrelink recipient. It's not going to have the same effect. So there is sort of that, you know, real politic approach to governance. And in fairness to Morrison, it's not just him. It's not just him. It's not just the Liberals. It's happening across the world. You know, you're seeing all these various different people just keeping going with the extended pretend forever. And I mean, it's even like these the continuation of the insolvency moratorium. I don't think that the Liberal Party is really all that keen on that, to be completely honest with you. Some of their candidates, some of the people in the Liberal Party are small business owners. They know what it's like to deal with people not paying invoices and how painful that can be and how much that can impact their business. And they're going to be hearing that from the rank and file from these business owners by the thousands. I will guarantee that. They're going to be getting letters from these people complaining about this. But at the end of the day, they also know that if they let this bomb go off now, it's going to blow up in their face, and it is going to hit the economy very, very hard, because it's going to cost jobs, businesses are going to close, and they'd much rather just, you know, keep going with extend and pretend, and, you know, they just think, oh, well, worst case scenario, you know, mini Christopher Scases across the country just blow up a couple of thousand businesses.
But the point is this, borrowing costs are very low at the moment, right? And if you look at the Treasury projections, the amount they were putting aside effectively to cover the interest costs, even though the loan size is a lot bigger than it was, it is lower than it was a decade ago, right? So that's worth just thinking about, right? And in New Zealand, of course, they actually got to the point where government bonds were actually negative. So effectively, international investors were basically paying New Zealand to borrow to support their economy, right? So that's the context for this, right? And the second point is that if you believe that it's a popularity contest and it's all being set around the next election, I'm pretty convinced that in the October budget, there will be a considerable number of extension strategies for some of these support mechanisms, or it will be a different flavour, but it will actually continue. And it will continue into next year and beyond, because from a vote perspective, that's the surest way to make sure that you actually do get the votes to continue, unless you actually know in your heart of hearts it's all going to blow up. And what you really want to do is make a good fist of it up to the election, and then hand the exploding bomb, as it were, to the other side and let them make a mess of it for the next few years and then come back after that. I don't know which of those two strategies is right, but it'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall in some of the Canberra discussions, because I'm sure that those strategies are being explored.
Oh, it's politics, you know, it's politics. All every anything and everything is explored. You know, what has mileage, what has traction, what doesn't, you know, it's all just part of the system, you know, as it stands. And I mean, realistically, you know, what do they say? You know, the public gets the government they deserve, but you know,
that's a scary thought.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It is. But it's interesting to think about just sort of like where all this is coming from, because, you know, when News Poll was 54-46, the Liberals were well out in front. ScoMo was considered, you know, a god here on earth by the public in terms of his approval rating. Then, yeah, sure, an early election makes sense. But I think the problem is that, once again, we're in the situation where if you look at Australia and you look at extend and pretend and you look at all these other different strategies, yeah, okay, things are sort of working for them. You know, the public has bought the strategy hook, line and sinker, because the thing is, you know, we had people, including yourself and I, who were looking at this and thinking without a government intervention, this thing is going to blow up. And it would have. You know, I think that's a relatively undisputed fact.
Yep.
But now here we are 6 months later and the public's like, well, you guys said things would blow up. That hasn't happened. You know, I heard CBA saying that 32%, you know, 32% housing price drops, and oh, it hasn't happened in my area, so everything's fine. So they've got a lot of mileage out of that. But by the same token, in terms of the sort of a broader viewpoint, we are at the mercy of the global tides. And even if we do have an election at the earliest possible date, it's still about 11 months away. So if we do, for example, see a slowing China and they go, oh, crap, maybe we can't go into all this debt to keep buying iron ore by the bucket load every day forever and ever, or maybe, you know, whatever ends up being that driving force behind the effect on the global economy, there is sort of all those other various different things that could impact that. And I think that that's why it's very, as you say, with all the different variables, it's very difficult to nail down what exactly is going on and what exactly the strategy is going to be, because it can change so rapidly. Like, I mean, when we spoke about it a few weeks ago, an early election when you're sort of 8 points ahead in the polls sounds like a fantastic idea. But when you're 50-50 and potentially heading into an uncertain future, all of a sudden you go, oh, well, maybe we'll just serve out the full term, lose the election, and then Labor can deal with it.
Well, that's my point, I think, that in a way there is a time to just say, let's let the other side make a mess of it, and then we'll come back and clean it up again, right? So, I don't know. It really is, you know, perhaps too early to call it one way or the other. But I do think you're right also about the context here. So I'm looking at the China-Australian relationship decaying even as we speak. You know, with you know, the media issues with you know, reporters being kicked out, and then everybody throwing brickbats both ways. The fact that more of the trade looks at risk at the moment, and maybe iron ore will be safe, but who knows? And then I look at the US election coming up, and you know, the uncertainties there. And then I look to Europe and what's happening between the UK and Europe with regard to Brexit, no Brexit, or, you know, basically tearing up the deal and starting again. And meantime, just to, you know, make it clear to people, in Europe, the virus is still increasing in terms of momentum. So, you know, the UK has just now introduced no more than six people. That's six people, sorry. No more than six people to meet, right, because of the fact that now the infection rates have risen. So the virus is still there. It's still raging. It's still, you know, being an important dampener on things. And I keep saying to people, understand this, right? Whatever you want to do in terms of fixing the economy, right, until you fix the virus, this is going to be a very rocky road.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to remember that, like, I say the debate on social media all the time. There's the virus isn't a big deal. The virus is a big deal, but it can be treated with hydrochloronique. There is all these different perspectives.
Plandemic.
Yeah. Yeah. So now, I'm it's not, you know, I don't think that that's that really matters, to be completely honest, in the purely the economic context, because at the end of the day, governments have already made the decision that this is how we're going to address the virus.
Yep.
And that's what we're seeing at the moment in the UK and in the rest of Europe. Because, you know, they're all closing, you know, not so much closing down again, but I mean, if you can't have more than six people in a room together, it doesn't really make for much of a vibrant economy, especially when, you know, I mean, compared with Australia, you know, rather than in places like Britain or Germany or wherever, everyone sits down the pub or outside a restaurant, has a nice meal, a glass of wine and a smoke and everything, you know, and that's the lifestyle in those places. So it's really, really quite important to their economies. But, you know, I mean, here in Australia, we've got our McMansions and, you know, our Uber Eats and our 2 minute noodles, depending on how you've done with your mortgage. And that's sort of, you know, that's sort of the way things are. But I think it's really important to look at, say, for example, for Europe at their data in terms of the PMIs and all those sorts of things. Germany is doing, you know, relatively speaking, quite well.
Mm.
But for the rest of Europe, for places like France and Spain, who are now being hit again by the virus, that they were already tanking back into recession before the virus took off again. So, I mean, it's all well and good for people to say, oh, but Australia's reliant on China. But it's like, yes, but we live in a global economy.
Mm.
China sells their stuff everywhere. If you know, if France and Spain or the UK, because I mean the UK is one of Germany's biggest trading partners, if they drag down Germany, China gets dragged down with them, because they're all of a sudden they don't have the consumers, and it's all just this big giant web of interconnected systems, and that's the way the global economy works, and that's how the Depression spread. Back in 1929, it wasn't just all just boom, everyone's unemployed just because, you know, some stockbroker jumped out of a window on Wall Street. You know, it spread slowly but surely throughout the financial system, and it took years and years and years for unemployment to peak in these places. It wasn't something that happened overnight. And I think that that's something that you've really hit on in a lot of your videos. That's really, really key in this entire discussion, is that this isn't a short-term thing. It's a longer-term thing, despite what all these various spruikers and everyone else might say. If the rest of the world's economy is suffering, we will too.
Yep. No, you're right. And, you know, I don't want to blow my own trumpet, but I think I was probably one of the first people to say, look, you got to be thinking this not just in a few months, but in 3 to 5 years, right? That's the experience after the global financial crisis, as we've experienced in other recessions previously. And it's interesting, there was a chart, I might throw it up at this point, from Bloomberg, showing what's happened to multiple economies. And you basically see a big sort of drop down, and then a bit of a rise, and then a plateauing. But the plateauing is happening at a much lower level. So just like the Reserve Bank forecast that our GDP would be lower relative to before we started in 3 to 5 years' time in their modelling, that's happening everywhere. So we've got a smaller economy. We've got more issues with regard to the momentum that's there. And you know, the virus is still in the background as well. So that's really important. The other point is worth just looking at the airlines, right? The airlines are now saying it's unlikely that they'll be back to full, you know, flight mode for 3 years.
Yes.
That's something which people just haven't latched into. 3 years, right? So what that is saying is that our international borders, whether they're open or not, will not see the sorts of people that we had previously coming in, migrants and also tourists coming into Australia for 2 or 3 years. And yet people are expecting it all to bounce back. It's not feasible.
No, it's not. And like just yesterday, Air New Zealand announced that it was grounding its 777 fleet, which is, you know, the Boeing long haul aircraft.
Yep.
But those aircraft are going to continue to be grounded until July next year at the absolute earliest.
Yep.
Now that speaks volumes. That says to me that we are not going to see anything like even decent, what we would have considered, you know, sort of even crap. We're not even going to see crap tourist numbers until then, if Air New Zealand's sort of strategy and their approach is anywhere near correct. And just to go back onto the point of China for a moment, that particular thing, you know, China and its relationship with Australia and its relationship with the region is evolving extremely rapidly at the moment. Mm. You know, you're seeing them coming to, not to blows, but you're seeing them, you know, having issues with Taiwan, having them with Vietnam, with India, with Japan, with all these different people. And I'm not sure if you saw recently, but the Undersecretary of State, Stephen Biegun for the US, he came out and said that basically the US is proposing, at least in a longer term view, for Australia to be part of a Pacific NATO that encompasses Australia, Japan, India, and the US. Mm. Now, if we do that, if we join that, China is going to go absolutely bloody ballistic. You know, if there's anything that could get them to basically cut off all trade bar iron ore and the things that they actually need from us tomorrow, it's that. And that is what America is increasingly pushing for. Now, don't get me wrong. If Biden wins the election, it could be a completely different ballgame. We don't know what his foreign policy is going to be like. And there's this great quote by this former Special Forces guy and author, what's his name, Jack Murphy. And he says, the problem with the US is that foreign policy can completely change every 4 years. So that may be the case, or it may not. You know, we may see this continued escalation, this continued sort of coalition building against China. And, you know, we're not really prepared for that here.
No, well, I think that's true. But I've got another way of asking that question. I wonder, and, you know, I've got no evidence for this, it's just my theory, but I wonder whether actually China is being opportunistic, given all of the economic uncertainties in so many parts of the world and the political uncertainties. Maybe it's decided that this is the time to exercise its muscle and just demonstrate that it is really a big bully in the playground and is going to hold its ground, and is effectively made the calculation that it can actually extend and actually position itself better by being more muscular and aggressive rather than not, simply because of what's happening globally. I could be wrong, but I just have that sort of bit of a sense that might be there as well.
Well, I think that's the thing in this instance. You can't rule anything out because we don't know, especially with China. Like, all of this data is so obscure and is so distorted by what we actually see. Like, I read stuff from China Beige Book, who are a great research agency that looks into China, and they put out some absolutely fantastic statistics, and they basically say the Chinese economy is in deep trouble. But then you read the mainstream statistics provided by the Chinese government, and then you go, oh well, that looks pretty good, but I mean, obviously it's statistics from the Chinese government, so you're not going to take them at face value. But as far as your point goes in terms of, you know, China's strategy, I think that they, how do I put this, they're taking advantage of the situation, in my view, to leverage their lack of demand. Like, I don't think that demand has recovered in China, and even their own retail sales statistics show that. So basically, if they can say, oh, we're not going to buy your beef, or we're not going to buy your barley, and we're not going to buy your wine. But at the end of the day, I think, and some China analysts share this view, that's just them masking their own weakness, their own lack of demand.
Right.
And part of me wonders if the sort of the more muscular approach is just to satisfy the domestic populace who is struggling, who is looking for someone to blame for all of this. I mean, it's sort of the oldest trick in the book.
That's right. Look over here, not over there. It's called misdirection, right? And actually, that takes us right back to where we started, right? Because actually, I think there's misdirection here in Australia too, which is essentially, you know, don't look at the real economy. Look at this other stuff over here. Look at all of the, you know, all the stuff that we've done. Look at all the support, et cetera, right? Because everything's fine, folks. And prices will be back up next year. And, you know, we'll be living in green pastures, and the music will be playing, and the sun will be shining, and, you know, we'll be in those wonderful uplands. And in the real world, you know, day to day, we might be somewhere different. But as we said at the start, extend, pretend.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's what works. You know, that's what's worked so far on the public. They've completely bought it hook, line, and sinker. And in all fairness to the everyday person, the shopping centre is more lively. People are spending money. And as far as they're concerned, in terms of everything, I mean, why wouldn't they? They've got 16% more money in their pockets on average.
until they haven't. Tarek, it's good to talk to you once again, and thanks for sharing your perspective today. And we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, definitely. Looking forward to it.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Bye.